This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. You know, in my opinion, I think there are few illusionists in the world who can compete on the same level as our guest here this week. I am talking, of course, then about Franz Harari, who is known as a mega illusionist because of the size, just the pure size of things he works with on stage and outdoors. Most of them can't even fit on stage, but many of the things are outdoors, like the space shuttle and Taj Mahal and goodness, other kinds of things, Tower Bridge in London and cars. Well, of course, cars he can do on stage. Anyhow, only a couple come to mind. Of course, David Copperfield, Luis de Matos, and there may be a few others, but not coming immediately to mind, of those who are just well-known international stars of magic who compete on the same level. And I say that because Franz Harari has been someone who has been around for a very long time and has not only been performing within the U.S., but internationally, and working in outdoor coliseums in Asia for, near 100,000 people. Well, we'll talk about that here in the podcast. But beyond that, it has also close ties to celebrities. That is, of course, he is perhaps best known in working with Michael Jackson, the late Michael Jackson, and also with his sister Janet Jackson. And there are many other celebrities he has worked for their music tours and other things like that. So to have rubbed shoulders with that kind of celebrity status person or people, I guess, if you will, again, there are few illusionists in the world who do that. There are several illusionists around, but they are out touring or doing their own show or doing their own thing, but really have not had this wide of an interest in other kinds of things. For an example, the first thing that Franz and I talk about here this week has to do with space and space exploration and that kind of a thing. And although that is a passion of his, he quickly says, I don't think anyone else really is interested in that. But I didn't cut that out because I thought that was an important part of what and who Franz is. I'll also point out here at the beginning, as we record these episodes, I like to keep them fresh. I always want them to be timeless, so they are just as relevant 10 years from now when people listen to this podcast, pull it up from the archives, or whenever they listen to it. It is still relevant as far and of interest in the future as it is now. So I like for my guests to try to keep things fairly, if not generic, at least not necessarily what's happening today. What did you have for breakfast? But moreover, kind of, and not necessarily an interview. This isn't something which I'm asking about their career and how you got started and what's your favorite color and, you know, who's your favorite magician. Nothing. That's not what this is about. You know, this is just a conversation between friends with no agenda. Everything is just very organic and it goes where it goes. And as you can tell in this conversation that Franz and I have, it can certainly certainly gone into different directions and taken a lot longer. And perhaps we might come back to revisit some of these things in future episodes. But because of his travels, it's difficult to try to keep him tied down. I know one thing he's been doing during the years of 2020 and 2021. He's been involved in doing an online evening show with John Pulham that's on Facebook, and it gives him an opportunity to bring in some people to chat about their careers and to give advice, and it's a wonderful show. And I have a similar show. Mine is kind of really more similar, I guess, to the podcast, and particularly mine is a virtual happy hour. If you haven't already tuned into that, it's available. And for those who may have missed past episodes over the past year that we've been recording these, they're available on YouTube and on Facebook on the Magic Word Podcast Facebook page and on YouTube/Texas Magician. Subscribe, if you will, please. I really could use your subscription so this way I can maybe eventually get my YouTube channel monetized, but I need to have more subscribers. So your help would be greatly appreciated if you go to youtube.com/Texas Magician and subscribe to that channel. That would help me a lot. lot. So anyhow, this is a little bit longer than usual, but this is a long overdue conversation with a friend who has so much to share, and he will open up and tell us some things here this week you've never heard before anywhere and may never hear again. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Franz Harari, here on The Magic Word. Today I've got with me someone who you know around the world. He is a mega illusionist. There are so many credits that I would spend the rest of the next 10 or 15 minutes trying to introduce him and tell you about his interests. And golly, I am not sure really where even to start when we start talking about all this, of whether it's going to be his work in Macau or work with Michael Jackson or his interest in outer space. And oh my goodness, just so many amazing things about this amazing friend. And might even get into a little bit of how we kind of got started when I had talked with him back at the Magic Castle probably 15, 20, 30 years ago. But who knows? Let's get our guest over here today. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Franz Harari. Hey, Franz.
Hey, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is indeed my pleasure to have you on the podcast over here after so long. I mean, I've been doing this for over 600 episodes, so I finally got you on here.
You're right. You beat me. As you well know, at the time of this recording, I've been doing my own little talk show Facebook thing, and I was proud to have 100 episodes. You got six. Although by the time this episode, you'll hit 1,000. So, kids, if you're watching this, you know, in the future, from the future, you know, Scott, congratulations on your 1,000th episode, Scott.
You're the first to congratulate me on my 1,000th episode.
Yes, congratulations. Glad I could be there for it.
That's the idea. Into the future and beyond. Speaking of the future like that as well, you have had an interest in space for a long time. I just kind of alluded to that. So I remember you made the shuttle disappear.
I made the U.S. shuttle vanish for the first ever episode of World's Greatest Magic. That was in 1994. And boy, we can talk an hour just on that. That was, by the way, I want to point out, before digital even existed. I mean, Jurassic Park had just come out, but nobody had any digital ability. And that was the first time I started getting accused of doing digital magic, even though digital literally didn't exist. That was in 1994. I vanished the space shuttle at Kennedy Space Center. And it was driven, one, because I had the opportunity to do something for this show. But more than that, I'm just a space geek. I just love everything about, you know, aerospace and the whole space culture. By the way, I did the Russian shuttle about seven years later.
The Soyuz?
Baran.
Baran, okay. Yeah.
The Russians had a show. It was basically a ripoff of the U.S. shuttle. But it was there. It was in Bahrain. How's that for confusing?
Wow.
The Baran shuttle was in Bahrain, the kingdom of Bahrain in the Middle East. And I managed to get my hands on it and do it again. By that time, I'd gotten good at it. I think, and I've been asked this more and more recently, why am I so into, you know, the space program? I think it's because when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, actually when I was seven, I hadn't turned eight yet, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And, you know, as a very young child, and you're a little bit older than I am, so you have a better memory of this, but I remember all of that, you know, following these guys were heroes and watching the Apollo program. And I, as a little kid, it affected me so strongly. And the message I got is, if you really put your mind to it, there are no limitations. You can do anything, you know, and it was really the first taste of real magic that I ever got. And I just loved that whole culture. The fact that everything could have blown up at any moment. A lot of people could have died, and we just freaking did it. And we did it without knowing what we're doing, and it worked. And I've really carried that with me my whole life. You know, I can say that everything that I've ever done professionally that was worth anything that kind of broke new ground, I wasn't totally sure if it's going to work or not. You know, and at any given time, something could have gone really bad, you know,
but you weren't afraid to try.
But you got to try, because if you don't, then you're doing the same, you know, CubeSag over and over and over for the rest of your life.
Well, that's true. And I do remember back when Armstrong first walked on the moon. It was on a Sunday night. It was black and white. And I was at a friend's house. We were watching that on TV that evening when it happened. And that was truly amazing. And in later years, I remember Walter Blaney having performed for the, it wasn't the Apollo astronauts, was it the Mercury mission?
Mercury, even before.
It was before that. It seems like he had performed. Do you remember the movie The Right Stuff?
Of course, of course, yeah.
And towards the end, there was they were performing like in the Astrodome, and I remember there was a fan dancer at the end or something like the way that it kind of ended, and all these guys were looking at each other, kind of reminiscing.
Oh, about that's right.
The whole program. That particular scene was based upon a true story, in which they did have a big celebration. Like, and Walter was part of that performing for them. And later, follow-up was he ended up performing for them when they invited him to come back, like for a celebration or a reunion of all of the astronauts and their spouses and some of the scientists and doctors. And he performed his ladder levitation then for him. And they said, "What can we pay?" And he said, "Nothing. You guys are the heroes of mine and of the world." And he said, "Well, we got to pay you something." He said, "Well, just give me a signed photo." So he's got a picture. Well, of course, he's passed now, but this picture on his wall that was a picture of, you know, planting the flag. And he said, "Walter, this is real magic, you know." So on the moon, it was amazing.
That's, you know, I've had the good fortune of, you know, meeting a few astronauts and playing in that world. And the first couple times that I spent time in that community, I was shocked to discover how they're not necessarily fun people. They're very focused.
It's like they're engineers.
That's what it is. You're hanging out with mathematicians.
Right.
You know, they're not us, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a very focused, very serious group. And, you know, I've kind of learned, I know where to poke now to get to them, you know? But it's a completely different culture, you know?
I assume, of course, in Florida, you've been down to, have you ever watched actually a
launch? Yes.
I've heard there's nothing like that.
I watched the launch. This was in 1990. Here's a story I've never told anybody.
Okay.
I was getting, and it's not a particularly good story, so brace yourself. I was getting ready to do a TV show for CBS called SeaWorld Summer Night Magic. And I was doing magic with penguins and the water ski show at SeaWorld. So, and a bunch of other stuff, all SeaWorld Orlando. And while I was down there, it happened to be that the shuttle that was sending up the Hubble Space Telescope was taken off. So I kind of played hooky from my pre-production work that I should have been doing. And I drove over. Now, I didn't go all the way. You didn't have to go very far. I only drove like 20, 30 miles, and you can see it, you know, what's happening. And I remember seeing that take off. That was pretty cool. And then, of course, the shuttle broke and it didn't do anything. Not the shuttle, but the Hubble just didn't do anything for many years. And we should, you know what? We've got a whole audience that's waiting for us to talk about magic. We shouldn't be talking about aerospace subject, you know.
Real quickly, one of my favorite stories was I actually saw Apollo 11, the ship that went to the moon, the first one that went to the moon.
You're 18 years old.
I was 18. I was in high school and I lived in Illinois, and my friends from high school had all planned on taking this trip, our senior trip, to go to Florida. We drove down there and several of us drove to the Space Center. We saw that on the landing the launch pad basically. And they were actually, it wasn't there yet. They were moving it. It moved like about 1 foot per hour or something, you know, because how heavy
three feet per hour. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyhow, I got to see that, took some pictures of it. So I got to see Apollo 11 before it launched.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I remember the story when the guy was giving us.
Again, none of our viewers care about this, but I think it's cool.
So, well, the guy who was the tour guide was saying, as you look around over here, that's the launch pad, and here's the buildings, and over there are some summer for houses, and said, "What's a summer for house?" He said, "Well, summer for men and summer for women." Okay, you got me. So, magic-wise, so that was a huge thing, and you were kind of always known for doing mega illusions and big illusions. And I remember working at the Magic Island, and one time going into Scott Hollingsworth's office, who was the entertainment director, and he had a video from you, and we were looking at it, and he said, "I can't book Franz." He said everything on this tape. It's like the smallest thing was making a motorcycle disappear, but everything was outside. It was the shuttle. There were cars.
You know, and that That continues to be one of the stupider things I've done in my career, because everything I do, there's some volume to it. And so there's a lot of places I can't work. And I remember in 08, if you remember, the whole world economy took a dump. Well, I guess we're, you know, it happened again in the world of COVID, because we're speaking from the future.
When, yes,
think
we are.
Think back 10 years ago to COVID. Well, and you know, when the whole economy fell apart, the first people that came back was what we call a one guy and his wife act. You know, a guy who could show up with, you know, whatever is in the back of his SUV and set it up and work with his wife. And it kicked my butt, because in order for me to look good, I need a minimum of 17 people, and I look a lot better with 30. You know, so,
and a wind machine.
Yeah, and a lot of wind machines, yes. Yeah.
Make the hair flow.
Yeah, and it's gotten even worse, because I'm worthless without a giant LED screen behind me. But it took, you know, it took a while for just the economics of the situation to even allow me to perform again. So it's not necessarily a smart thing I did, but I knew going in when I was producing my show, that I wanted to play in a very big medium, because I always felt, and here's another mistake, is I never was drawn towards close-up magic. Not that I don't respect it. I've got a ridiculous amount of respect for manipulation and sleight of hand. I just suck at it completely. Okay. I have the manipulation skills of a monkey, of a chimpanzee. So I was never drawn to it, because back in the day, I always thought, well, you know, even if I get really, really good at close-up, I'm only going to work for 10 or 15 people at a time. But if I can, you know, if I can learn to work on stage and in a bigger venue, then I can hit more people. I'm going to be able to cover more ground, get a bigger audience, do more. And I knew that going in. But what happened is, over decades, my product grew so big, and my manipulation skills continued to be that of a sloth, you know. And as it grew bigger and bigger, it became more and more difficult to play the magic castle, you know, to do the church basement or the bar mitzvah, you know. So I kind of shot myself in the foot, because I was forced to find venues big enough to do what I do and that could afford what I do. And that eventually meant leaving the United States and going to Asia and Southeast Asia and the Middle East, because that's where the market, at the time, it really was virgin. There was so much opportunity there.
Well, they were huge. And also the stadiums where you performed, there were like 170,000 people.
Right. Yeah. So not 170, I did 110. That's my record.
Okay. But I don't want to exaggerate. Okay. So it's over 100,000.
But we're in the future. So maybe it's 170.
Maybe they'll expand.
You know? But, you know, there's no place in the United States where any magician, who's the top magician of our time? Is it Copperfield, Chris Angel,
David Blaine?
David Blaine, whoever, you know, none of these magicians would be able to sell at a stadium, because magic just isn't celebrated as it is
in the U.S.
Yeah, in the United States as it is overseas. So
why is that, you think?
Boy, that's another podcast right there. We can do that for another hour. There's another hour right there.
Wow.
It's okay. Magic. I'll tell you this.
Just in a thumb tip, what would it be?
In a thumb tip. I produced a TV series a while ago called Magic Planet. And it's basically, I just brought a little video crew with me everywhere I went. And as this series started kind of revealing itself, what I realized is that every country we went to, the magic, and by the way, after like episode two or three, and the word started getting out there, I used to be bombarded with all the local magicians of that country, of that that city. And what became really clear to me is that once you get beyond the obvious stuff, once you get beyond the fact that everybody wanted to be Lance Burton or David Copperfield, the people that were genuinely doing indigenous magic that was born of their culture, all of that magic reflects and reflected the hopes and dreams of that culture. You know, if you look at Chinese magic, what is Chinese magic? You're making food appear, rice and fish and Well, you look back in Chinese history. Yeah. Yeah. You go to Southeast Asia and it's the debus and overcoming pain and over, you know, walking on fire. And it's, here's a country that's lived with earthquakes and volcanoes. And us as Americans, we're capitalists. So I'm making cars and planes appear and women appear. You know, it's weirdly,
oh, I see the difference.
It is a reflection
of society,
of our dreams. Yeah. Of our dreams. So that's partially why magic is so much more powerful overseas than the United States, because we've become tainted in the United States. We're sort of over it. And, you know, especially in Southeast Asia, especially in the Middle East, where magic is just kind of finding itself. It's so powerful because, for one, a lot of people still believe that it's real.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. But it's again, this is a 2-hour podcast, so we'll just leave it at that, you know.
Okay. Well, the fact you were doing these huge shows then in overseas in Asian countries.
Everywhere, really. Yeah.
Yeah, you were. And you had to learn different languages. How many languages do you speak now?
I grew up speaking German, and I have never worked in Germany. So there you go.
That's weird. Okay.
I've never spoken Germany. No, I've never spoken German professionally. My wife's Japanese. And so I speak Japanese like Tonto the Indian speaks English.
Okay.
And I speak like a toddler. And I can get by in Thai. I'm okay. I've had to move to Bangkok. I could do that. And, you know, a little bit of Chinese, but you only need 50 words to do a show. You need, hi, I'm Franz Ferrari. Welcome. Come with me. What's your name? Sit here. Take this. Do that. Thank you. Applause, please. Let's hear it for him. Watch this. You only really need 50 things at most, and you got your whole show. So yeah. I got those in Cantonese. No, Mandarin. I got those in Mandarin, which, by the way, I was doing, here's an example. We're doing a pretty big show. This was 34,000 people in Guangzhou, in the Guangzhou Olympic stadium there. And four shows. And during the show, I decided that I'm going to I walk out on stage. And in China, the equivalent is saying, hey, what's up? How you doing? You know, what's happening is, hey, have you eaten? You know, that's a real casual thing. Have you eaten? Which is churlama, yeah. Nihama, Wataminze Franz Harari, churlama. Have you eaten churlama? So say that to your Chinese buddies and they'll go, huh? What? Churlama. It'll be like, you know, going into Central Africa and they don't speak a word of English, but you'd hear them go, yo, bro, what's happening? Yeah. It's that kind of thing. So churlama. So I just learned that and I'd rehearsed it and I'm feeling all good about myself. The afternoon before, I was hanging out with some of my local buddies there, and they had taught me to say chao ni ma, and I'm assuming there's not too many Chinese people listening to this, but can I swear on the show? Or is this, we want to keep it clean.
You can, I can.
No, we'll just, no, I'll just clean it up. Chao ni ma literally means go fornicate with your mother, basically.
Okay, then.
So. But much more rude than that, you know.
Big difference between just that little syllable. Yeah.
So as you can imagine, I walked out and 34,000 people, and I said, you know, go
the wrong phrase.
You know, go do it with your mother.
F yourself.
But go F your mother, basically. And there was silence. I'd never heard an audience that big go silence. But I think they were just confused. They didn't believe that they were hearing what they were hearing from this American, you know. Another time I'm in where the hell was this? This is in Argentina. I'm doing a show called Ritmo de la Noche. And even though I've lived in LA for 35 years, my Spanish is terrible. So I'm doing this thing. I have this one illusion. Just work. I don't really title any of my illusions because I think it's dumb, but that's another subject. But I have an illusion that amongst my team, we call 2D because it's basically becoming flat. It's entering the second dimension. So I did this for this, basically the equivalent of the Tonight Show over there. And I become flat and I enter. It's all about more science, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Basically, it's about the anthropic principle, about Stephen Hawking's theory on multiple universes. And so I go into this two-dimensional universe and I come back and blah, 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 blah. So when it's all done, I'm sitting now at the panel and the guy goes, "Where did you go?" And I go, "Well, where did I go? I didn't go anywhere. I went into another dimension, but where did you go?" And I said, "I became flat. I became flatto." And they go, "What?" And suddenly they all start cracking up. "Flatto, I became flatto," which I am now told in Spanish means fart. So I became Mr. Fart or some version of that. Anyway, to go back, but I touched on another thing, is a lot of my magic, all of my magic, I will say, is based on stuff that I find fascinating, which kind of going back to space and science and now, you know, quantum physics and particle physics, that those ideas are reflected in my illusions. And I've discovered it's really come to bite me in the butt because it doesn't work. In the case of this, this thing with Stephen Hawking called the anthropic principle, even though in my mind I'm stepping into a parallel universe with a different set of scientific principles and laws, mm-hmm. it's too much science. And to the audience, I just done disappeared. I turned into a shadow. You know, the audience will always break it down to the lowest common denominator. I did a thing years ago that is about time travel. So I build this machine and I travel to the future. I travel 3 minutes into the future and then I return with somebody from the audience. And that person is now a clone of somebody in the audience. And then as time moves forward, what was the future becomes the presence from the present. And now you see me from 3 minutes ago pop into that present, snag the person from the audience, and suck them back into the past.
Wow.
So mathematically, it all works out. You know, the geometry is all there.
And the time-space continuum.
That's right. That's right. I have to turn on my flux capacitor.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the end, it's too much thinking for the audience to do. And I remember I tried this in Atlantic City for like 3 months. And in the end, the audience just goes, "Huh, so first you disappeared, and then you made a girl appear, and then there's a second one of you made appear, and then the both of you disappeared." So the storyline, the thread of it
it's confusing.
Never got comprehended. And I tried everything. I tried doing these big giant storyboards on stage. I tried making this film strip that shows the timeline.
Right.
Couldn't do it. And about $80,000 later, I realized that basically I built this really cool prop that looks like this retro tech thing that will make somebody appear and disappear. And so the whole idea of time travel just went to hell. And I still use the prop, but I use it to make CEOs appear.
Well, I think the whole idea is still there and a good one. I recall I'm referring to David Copperfield of having that little alien that he was fiddling with that when that first came out, and he wasn't happy with where it was going. But rather than tossing it or turning it into something else, he continued to work with it. And each night was coming up with different ideas. And as the weeks, months, and years progressed, he developed into something completely different.
I don't think I'd give something a year. I'd give something like 3 months.
Okay.
If I can't get it to work in 3 months, then it was not meant to be. Then
There was something I want to go to. We talked about some time ago when you were in Macau, and I'm going to lead up to this, because you were telling me about how that you had. You were saying that the front row at that theater there in Macau was just literally a few feet away, it seems like.
5-6 feet away,
Feet away. And I was thinking the mega illusions you're doing, like you said, with 17 assistants, et cetera, right. how can that be? And when you're used to using these 110,000 plus type theaters and venues where the nearest person is 100 yards from you, from the stage or edge of stage or something. And you had some good thoughts on that. I want you to share that.
I've had a lot of thoughts. I'm not sure which ones I told you.
Well, as I recall, you were just saying it was just the intimacy. You noticed
The
people.
Well, I noticed this is something that I discovered by accident, because when I was designing the place, it was a pain in the butt, because as you well know, Illusions, or at least traditional illusions at the time of this recording, are
Back in 2021.
Way back then, you know, during the pandemic, they are largely based on the manipulation of depth perception, the manipulation of relationship between shadow and light, and spatial relationship, and the use of shapes and objects that are utilitarian as opposed to those which are for display or focus. And so it's that it's that disconnect between the right and left side of your brain, the new information and old information. So it's messing, it's playing in that world that makes big illusions work, at least mine.
Okay.
But if you're really, really close, then a lot of that goes to hell. And you're back into the world of platform magic of, you know, you're into Jim Steinmeier world, you know, interlude and origami, which are freaking brilliant, you know, designs. Yeah. And they'll work 5 feet away from you. Not so much the case with me. But I learned, I was forced to make all my stuff work, you know, 5 or 6 feet away. But the other thing that I discovered is I was getting, during the show, because I was giving a relatively small audience, per cycle, we did 900 people. The same show as I would do for a stadium, but very, very close. And I realized that it was the same experience as when we're in an arena, you know, any kind of a large stadium venue, technical rehearsal, the afternoon before the first show, all the lights, sound, LED, everything is up. You're at full force. You're in costume and you're doing this thing balls out, only the entire audience is made up of the cleaning crew, the people setting up the chairs, the security crew, you know, so it's 50 or 100 people that happen to be right there in that afternoon prepping for the show. And so they kind of stop what they're doing and they stand there and they all collect up at the front of the stage and they stand there and they watch and they become your audience. Huh. And my whole team, we end up doing a show for that 100 people made up of the cleaning ladies and, you know, the ticket takers.
Maintenance personnel and everybody.
Yeah. And so it becomes a very personal thing.
And intimate.
Yes, very intimate, but still massive, you know?
Right.
And there's this real magic in there that you wouldn't expect existed, but that's what happened. And so in Macau, that's what happened. It was like we produced this giant thing, and then we did it for a pretty small audience, and so much connection was made with the audience that that I learned a lot, for one. Which, by the way, I've also found tricks. And you just did my show, Talking Magic, which, even though this is 20 years ago, we should feel free to promote that on Facebook every Tuesday live. I've had, this will be my 100th episode from the past. On your show.
Well, you are a future man.
That's right. That's right. On that show, you were giving away so much information, and I was just floored with how much information you've given away. And then,
we didn't have much time. I couldn't only give away.
But I say that, as a segue, because I'm going to tell you something that I haven't told really anybody for fear of giving this away, but I feel I'm it's time to,
since I shared, you're going to share.
Exactly. It's a giving thing.
It's a giving. So, that's right.
So I am able to forward. That's it. Paid forward to like the 10 guys who will be able to use this, or women. Okay. So I discovered the biggest handicap that I've got working in big venues is trying to communicate, trying to make that connection to own that audience. And you know, as a performer, that an audience becomes a single animal. They somehow spiritually all connect together into a single being. And you can almost mold that being like a big giant piece of Play-Doh. And you figure out where the hot spots are and where the good spots and the cold spots are. And then if there's a cold spot, you start working towards that spot and you try to get everybody to warm up. I found that to bring energy up in a live audience, it's like having a wine glass and making it wet and then rubbing the rim and going, you know, that to get
right,
it just right. You got to get it just perfect. And once it gets going loud, you can get that glass to scream. But right. That's what working with an audience is. It's finding how to rub them just right to get them to sing for you.
Isn't that kind of like jazz magic in a way? Because in other words, with jazz, you're kind of going with where the audience is taking you.
Right, right.
It's why you got to find out where they are. You got to find that spot.
Yeah, I think it's actually true for all performance arts. I think singers do it. Certainly comedians do it. So I think it's finding where your audience is and then getting them to sing, you know. Now, the problem is if you're dealing with a stadium, 30, 40,000 people, it's very, very difficult to connect with everybody. And as a magician, again, this is stuff you know, Scott, you got about 30 seconds to do that. If they don't love you in the first 10 or 15 seconds, it's downhill. You know,
you got to grab them.
Yeah, you need to.
First impressions are very important on stage.
Yeah, yeah. You need to own them in that first 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. They got to decide not only you're good, but that they like you, that they're somebody that they're going to embrace for the next hour and 45 minutes or whatever it is, you know.
Unless you're someone who is a celebrity. If you're coming in and you're, let's say, you're Michael Carbonaro or someone, again, who has a television celebrity presence, if you will, and they have expectations. I remember seeing the guy who was on Seinfeld that played.
Jason Alexander.
Jason Alexander. When he performed, and people had an expectation of being a funny guy. And when he first comes on stage and performs, actually doing mentalism, he does a silent thing. It's a John Allen effect when the card ends up in his mouth or whatever. And so he kills people with a great trick. But but the first impression is, because he is who he is and he brings that celebrity status to the stage, people that have an expectation.
Right.
But that's very rare. Most of us, as you say, they're saying, who is this guy? It's Franz or Scott. They don't.
Yeah, it's your posters. But when they see me, all they know of me usually, there's a handful of places in the world where I've got celebrity. But for the most part, I'm a bunch of posters and a bunch of television advertisements. So all they know is the trailer. They just know you from the promo. So back to be able to gain a large audience, what I'll do is about 20 minutes, half hour, 20 minutes before the show starts, I'll take a cameraman with me, usually like one assistant, and we'll go to the very, very far side of the stadium, very, very back row, and we'll turn on the camera light, and I'll start doing some BS interview or whatever. It's nothing really, you know, just to look like we're doing a shoot. Once the camera light is on, I've got the attention of, you know, 300-400 people back there. And so then I'll start shaking hands and taking selfies and what have you. So with that, I'm able
to... As you're working your way towards the front, towards the stage.
Not even that. I work like the 1,000 people in the very, very back. And I tried to touch everybody. You know, I tried to physically... Well, maybe not now, post-COVID. We'll see how that goes. Physically shake hands or touch everybody, take 100 selfies and connect with that 1,000 people, because that's about how many
in the back of the
very
room.
very back of the stadium.
Excellent suggestion. Wow, that is some impressive stuff.
Because what happens is, if you own them, then when they see you on stage, you're going to be able to own the first 1,000 people in front of you. You get those for free because they're so freaking excited just to be there. You know, you get them. But as that energy pushes forward into the audience, at the same time, you've got the 1,000 people at the very, very ass end of the place also pushing that energy forward. So that energy, it is addictive. It's an infestation, and it moves through the stadium, and very, very quickly I'm able to fill up that middle section, which is the hard part to reach.
Few people are Franz Ferrari. Few people are mega illusionists. I can't really think of another one but you right now offhand in the world. I know there are others, but then others who are illusionists. But to bring this to people who, like myself, who will be doing stage shows for corporate audiences after dinner kind of a things, there have been a lot of times in which obviously there are people back at the bar, or they are disrupting because they're having their own conversation. But you hit upon an excellent idea that we can incorporate in a smaller venue, in a smaller show, before your show begins, to go back to the bar, do some close up for these guys, let them know who you are, and that you know you see them and you can hear them. And so then later they feel like they're part of the show.
Well, you know, the other thing that I've done for smaller audiences, if it's 1,000 people or less, or even a couple thousand people, is And by the way, promoters hate this when when you are sold as an illusionist, as a name, they're buying into the hype. They're buying into the celebrity of it all, even though most of the time there is no celebrity. You know, but most of the we all have a very solid handle on who we are. There is no illusion, you know, about our fame or lack of it, at least not. But when you're selling yourself to a buyer, they're buying into this premise that somehow you're a star, even if you know,
I hear you.
You know, we're not, you know.
Yeah. We're humble people.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but before the show starts, again, if it's just 1,000 people, that's perfect. Even it works up to 2,000 people. What I'll do is I'll be in costume and I'll have my mic on and my pack and I'm all ready to go.
Sure.
So, but I'll take off my whatever my main jacket is and just put on some casual nothing jacket, you know?
Okay.
And walk through the audience. And again, very in this case, you got to start at the front of the audience because you want the whole audience to see you. And just start shaking hands and taking selfies. And what will happen is that will escalate as you walk through the crowd. Everybody now wants a piece of you. Once you get into the aisle, little kids are going to run from all over the audience and they're going to
swarm you.
Swarm you in the aisle. And now you become Mr. Selfie Guy in the aisle, trying to make your way up through all the way to the back of the audience. So you do this, I'll do this for about 10 minutes until I've literally touched, you know, 20% of the audience, taking selfies and hung up. Mm-hmm. By this time, the whole audience is watching me. Everybody's watching me because what else they got to watch?
Yeah, they're thinking, there he is. Here he comes.
Right, there he is. And then they're going, well, isn't the show going to start? Like, now the other thing is I've done my show so much that I can literally stroll off stage, hop into my low chamber and boom, go, you know?
Yeah.
So what I'll do is about a minute before the intro, the video starts, I'll pretend as though I'm getting, I have no communication with my guys other than I see the people at the back of house at the control center and they're talking, you know, visually, but I'll pretend as though I get a cue. And then I will find whoever I'm taking a selfie with, and I'll explain to them, I got to run, point to my invisible watch, and I got to run backstage. So now I kind of hightail it backstage, and the whole audience is watching me very, very quickly run off stage and out of sight. And so now they know something's going to happen. 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, they see on stage with the cool costume or whatever your look is.
Right.
And again, you've got that connection because 3 minutes earlier, you were a guy on stage. You were taking pictures with my kid. And now you're up on stage and you're big Mr. Hoop-de-doo magic star. And all right, I'm with you. I am connected to you because you came down and you shook hands with my mom and you took pictures with my kid and you're my friend now.
I love that. Well, you know, that's in a way, Banachek does a similar thing when he is introduced. Rather than coming in from the wing, from stage right over here, there, he actually everybody's watching the stage. All of a sudden, you hear some hoop-de-doo in the back, and he's not shaking hands, but he's walking down the aisle, and the spotlight's hitting him as he's walking from the back of the audience to the stage. It's just a different way of approaching the stage, certainly, than what people are used to, and they're thinking automatically, that is going to be a different performer. That's just not the regular kind of a guy.
Right.
Something, I mean, even not just in his regular performances, but at conventions and wherever else.
Something I started doing pretty recently, or in the case of this broadcast, something I started doing 20 years ago, is when I would introduce a guest act, I would, as I'm introducing them, I would step down into the audience so that by the time they're starting their segment, I could sit down in a seat that I kind of held for myself and sit and watch them in the audience. So the audience believes that I'm watching them with them on stage. Now, the truth be told, once I'm sitting there and the lights are down, I'm usually on my phone checking emails anyway. But but at least the audience believes that I'm there watching them along for the ride.
Well, before we go too far afield, there is something else I wanted to bring up. And I know you had worked with Michael Jackson way back when. And
26 years.
How long ago?
26 years of my life.
26 years of you worked with him. Wow.
Yeah. It's a, I'll try to compress this story. You know, this is one of those interview stories that I'm sure you've got yours as well that you've told hundreds of times.
Yeah, well, that's why I hate to ask questions that
aren't even paved.
I was curious about after he had passed, about how you may have been approached by the media to say, what stories do you have?
Oh, boy, that's a biggie. So
I mean, they probably approached everybody who had ever had any interaction with him, and you were with him a lot.
I'll kind of compress it. So it started, I was 20 years old. I was going to school at the University of Michigan and Eastern Michigan University. I was going to be a singer, going to go to Broadway on the scholarship. But the whole time I was doing magic, inventing magic for myself. And I'd convinced the director of the marching band, University of Michigan Marching Band, into letting me do magic for halftime shows. And so I sort of taught myself to create magic for stadium audiences. In 94, Jackson announces he's going out on the Victory Tour. About a month later, he burns his hair on the Pepsi commercial. They say the name of his attorney on television. I write it down. I call the attorney. I give him my big pitch. My name's Franz. I'm a 20-year-old magician from Michigan, and I could do magic for Michael. I'm speeding through a lot of this, but basically I ended up in L.A., met Michael. We were similar ages, so we became friends. I did that tour, and then from that became friends. And once you did Michael Jackson, you get everybody. I did his sister, Janet, and then Madonna and Prince and everybody. You know, that's who I became. I became the guy who designs magic for pop concerts. But all the same time, still friends with Michael. And when he bought Neverland Ranch, which was his big estate, I rigged it. The place is, nobody's ever talked about this. And maybe they don't know.
Now's a good time to talk about it.
Yeah. So I rigged the whole place. Whole place was filled with trap doors and secret passages. And we had a flying rig and the whole Aga levitation. So he could literally do pretty cool illusions anywhere he wanted for his friends.
Throughout the whole house, not necessarily just on the
whole
stage.
Wow. Whole house and the stage, yeah. In fact, Oprah did an interview with him where the two of them were sitting on a stage.
I saw that. I remember that.
If we go take a look at that again, Oprah's butt is about 3 inches away from one of my trap doors. And I thought, if she sits directly on that, that's not going to end well because that was not built particularly well. So anyway, so Michael, I was continuously just designing stuff for him just for fun, you know. And over the course of 26 years, I saw a lot. I saw his life.
Did he give you carte blanche to pretty much build and do whatever you wanted to do then? Or was he kind of like along with that? You ran it by him or what?
We were hanging. I'd go, so I had this idea for a whatever, you know. And he go, okay, well, let's try that. And usually we'd build it, play around.
Well, you almost sound like him.
You know, so actually very early in our relationship, he called me up with a fake voice and I didn't know it was him and I kept hanging up on him. Finally, he goes, no, don't hang up. It's Michael. No, don't hang up. So there's generated a lot of stuff. And what that meant is every time he got bored with a prop, usually in about 45 minutes, I would get it. So I would start in designing stuff that I wanted for my show, knowing that I'll build it for him. We'll play with it for an afternoon and then I'd get it. So that was a win-win relationship for both of us. But I was going to say, I saw his whole life, both professionally and personally. I saw that whole arc happening and it's more true than you want to believe. So his last tour, where am I going with that? I'll just say the last tour that he did was the History Tour, and for which he didn't want to do magic at the last minute. He calls me up and goes, Franz, change my mind. I want to do some magic. So as I'm driving to the rehearsal venue, I'm scribbling basically a spiker. It's not anything I'm particularly proud of. It's 50 spikes going through and this Iron Maiden thing, and it blows up with flash paper and gone. Again, not inspired, but good enough. And so he saw it. He liked it. We built it. It was for Thriller. So I did this.
For the video Thriller?
For the live version of Thriller.
Okay. The touring show. Okay.
Yeah, so I did this exchange. Everything I did was for touring. Because by this time in a video format, you really didn't need practical effects, you know? Hmm. So the thing where he changes into a werewolf and then he gets into this thing and the thing gets, these two halves of an Iron Maiden get closed around and 50 spikes go through and blah, 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 blah. So First time we did it, Kenny Ortega freaked out because he thought it was real and he stopped the whole rehearsal. I was really, really pleased with myself for that. But in the thing, there were like six different safeties, six redundancy safeties to make sure that I didn't kill Michael Jackson. When it was all done, when the tour was all done,
he probably had to sign a lot of insurance papers and stuff too.
Also non-disclosures. That's why I'm dancing in delicate waters here, but it's been so long ago. I think nobody cares
anymore.
You're
safe, I think.
Yeah. So when it was all done, again, he goes, "Hey, Franz, here, take this prop. Keep it for yourself. Keep our magic alive." You know, so I ended up keeping this prop, and I used it myself for like a decade or more because this was in the history tour. So before I did it on my own show, I would play this video of him and I hanging and the show itself and blah, 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 and Michael, and then you get to see the prop in the video, and then you see it on stage. And so it did pretty, I got a lot out of it. I really exploited the hell out of that thing. But because I did it for so long and it was me getting into it, over the years, I started getting rid of all of the redundancies.
Yeah.
All of the safeties until finally there were no safeties. I just freaking got in it and closed it and slid into the low chamber and boom and freaking do it.
And you're still alive.
Still alive. So we were in Abu Dhabi a long time ago. So speaking to us from the future, this was a freaking long time ago. And I slide into the low chamber, but the way it slides in is your hands kind of go last because you almost got to put your hands in the air and then slither in there like a wet smelt, you know? So my hands were still up in the actual Iron Maiden section of this thing. And the guys take these spikes and they ram it through, but they hit my hand and it pops halfway into my palm. And then it gets jammed because it couldn't go through the other half and pop out the back. So they pull it back and they get a running start and they do it again. And now they go pop and it goes pop out the back. And now I've got about an inch in diameter spike going through my hand. I'm lying on the ground, my arms up in the air, and I'm looking at the spike going through me and blood is running down my arm and it's in my face. And so now
you got
a
scar, obviously, on your palm of your hand.
I do. Yeah. It's probably too small to see in the video, but yeah. So I'm lying there and it's all bloody and the whole thing is aluminum because forget wood. At least for me, the days of wood are long gone. So because the thing
is more lightweight,
fire,
I guess. Too.
It's lightweight and you can do more with it and it's fireproof. So because the thing's got to catch fire. So now I'm lying in the low chamber and I'm looking up and my hand is going through this and I'm screaming, pull it out, pull it out, pull it out. And the technicians on stage are thinking, well, he's really taking this whole show more seriously than others because he's screaming and making it sound like he's really impaled. Okay, we'll go with it. So they pull it out and I pull my hand down and I'm lying in a pool of sweat and blood. And because I don't have a functional hand, I don't have the ability to cover. It's hard to explain, but there's an aluminum shield that I have to slide over my face to protect myself from the flash Spice. Paper.
Oh,
flash paper burst that is to come. So I know I can't do this. So it's like, okay, here we go. So sure enough, on the music, the techs hit, you know, they hit the button and the thing blows up. And I remember looking up and first thinking, well, wow, that's spectacular to see that giant burst of flash paper. And I've never seen it from this angle. Nobody has ever seen it from this angle ever because it was never intended. And then it's like, oh, sure enough, all the flash paper debris and all that drops on top of me. So now I'm lying in a pool of my blood and sweat and flash paper debris and char. And so I get rolled off stage and it's intermission and I'm just about to pass out. I get pulled out of the thing and I'm barely holding on to my faculties.
Do you not have a medic on staff or nearby?
We do, but nobody knows anything was wrong because it was just backstage. So I'm told that the first words out of my mouth is, "Where's the cameraman? Get Chris. Where's the cameraman?" Because I thought, if I'm going to pass out right here, I want to be shooting all this for a documentary. This is when I was shooting Magic Planet. So the camera op is there. He's following this whole thing. And
that's
now
a showman.
Now we documented the whole experience of me making it backstage, analyzing what's going on. am I going to go on stage? Am I not going to go off stage? Finally, we decided, no, I need to get rushed to a military hospital in Abu Dhabi, which is in the United Arab Emirates. But we have to do the second half of the show. So the second half of the show became all of the dance routines and Christopher Hart. So Christopher Hart was my guest at the time. He was the guest act. So he did like an extra spot. And we finished this big giant illusion show with Christopher Hart, which was probably the biggest billing he's ever had in his life. So
I assume that Chris knew what was going on. And
But this time
you're
going
to need to stretch and you're going to close. And
right. Everybody knew what's going on by that time. And I learned this was a long time ago, but the reason that I didn't close the show is because I have to do the math here. I learned 2010 years earlier, it would have been, wow, time moves fast. Huh? 10 years earlier, I also had an accident during a show. I ripped my kneecap and I felt like, well, I got to keep doing the show. I can't not do the show. I've got to do the show. So stupidly, I finished the show, but in doing the show, I destroyed my knee even further, and then I had to have knee surgery, and it leads to me. I haven't been able to run since then. I can walk quickly, but I can't run. So basically, I affected my life for the rest of my life because I stupidly felt like I needed to do that one show. That was so important.
And you're younger and thinking, impervious to this kind of pain.
I was like, I think it was 29, and it was Taipei. I remember it was Taipei Olympic Arena. And so it's a big audience. I'm going, oh, I got to do this show. I can't not do the show. I've got to do the show. So I did it, and stupidly.
It's like Houdini had pushed through after he had been in pain too. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just really stupid. So the first time you make that mistake, you learn it's just a freaking magic show. And when it's all done, all it is one more poster in your living room wall, and that's it. So.
Were there any occasions or incidents in which Michael Jackson had been near injury?
Well, is this only magicians or who's listening to this?
Yeah, pretty much. I have like 100%.
In the future. It's only magicians. So, no, he was never, at least not with me. He might have been with others because he did a lot. But when I was working with him, I never.
Yeah, there were other magic consultants. It wasn't just you. I mean, I know Mike Amar and was it Daryl? Yeah. I don't know who all used to be hang with him.
Yeah, I was like the illusion guy. Put it this way, this sounds really weird. I know there were other guys, but I never saw any of them. You know, and
well, I saw a picture of all of you one time. It was on.
I wasn't in there. In 1988, Michael. Here's a weird story. In 1988. The National Enquirer walk into my dry cleaner on Hollywood Boulevard, and my dry cleaner on the wall had a picture of me floating Michael with the Super X levitation that I had built on the road. And so they go, what's the story there? So my dry cleaner gives the National Enquirer my contact. I talk to them and I talk about which in 88, I'd only been doing this for 4 years with them. But mm-hmm. I told a little bit, this was even before Neverland and all that. So I talked to the Enquirer about my history and what we're doing. So they did a story on all the magic we'd done together. And when the article ran, as you said, there was also Michael Amar and a couple other guys in there. And I thought, well, I'll be damned. I didn't know that any of these guys existed. You know, it was like discovering that your girlfriend is also dating other people, you know. So I had no idea, you know, and they were buddies of mine, but nobody ever mentioned it. So my experience with Michael was one of going over to his house and hanging out on his Murphy bed, which is a little creepy in retrospect.
You don't need to go in and all that.
I saw the
documentary.
There you go. So it was really more, it was 50-50 magic and just sort of playing around. You know, I remember he had his chimpanzee. That was a nasty ass chimpanzee, by the way.
what was his name?
Bubbles.
Bubbles.
And I was making a handkerchief disappear with a thumb tip and the chimp would go crazy, you know, and then I go, okay, I get this. So the next time it came back, I brought a handkerchief on a reel, on an electric reel, and I made the handkerchief fly across, you know, his living room and the chimp goes. So I was just, at that point, I was just kind of pissing off the chimp, you know? So about half of my time with him was just playing around, basically playing around in a mansion. And the other half was doing magic. So it's,
yeah.
It was a good environment because it was it meant I could experiment with magic and say, hey, what if we did this? And
you
what
kind of had unlimited resources and a place to play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what the hell are we talking about? Oh, yeah, so risks. So I never took any risks with him. But the first thing I ever did, I was 20 years old and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I thought I wanted to make him float up in the air and disappear. And the only way I knew to do that was with an Azra levitation. So we did an Azra for the victory tour. And it all worked fine in rehearsals in the studio here in Los Angeles. But our first actual show was in Kansas City, Missouri, outdoor in Arrowhead Stadium. And so during tech rehearsals, which is when I first learned what even a tech rehearsal is,
Yeah.
And again, you got the audience of all the security guards, and in this case, all the record company weasels and management and all that. So they're all in the audience in their suits watching a tech rehearsal. He lies down on the table. We do the switch out, and now the Azra flies up in the air. And as you know, there's no weight to it. It's basically a kite.
Right.
So a little gust of wind comes in, and the Azra starts taking off like a kite, flying all over the stage. And firstly, I thought, wow, that was kind of cool. But then I looked into the audience and I saw his manager and the record company execs and all these guys, their faces were white as they're watching what they believe to be their $1 billion investment.
You think he's up there,
flying out of control. So I thought, all right, that's it for me. I'm headed back to Michigan. I'm doing birthday parties and car dealership openings for the rest of my life. And that's okay. That's not a bad life. I can do that, you know? So that's, I didn't put him out of, you know, in danger, but I realized who I'm playing with and the world that I'm playing with and the stakes that are involved. And I think because of that, I never really, I stayed away from risk, you know. I did a couple years later, I did Janet Jackson Rhythm Nation. That was 1990. That was great. So even with Janet, I didn't take any chances, but I was still toying with it. She did a song called Black Cat. And so I did basically, again, this is the beginning of my career. So there's not a whole lot of innovation going on. I just did a lion's bride, turning her into a Black Panther. But I had to teach her how to do it to get into the low chamber and all that.
Right.
And so we're inside the cage and the cover is covered up. And suddenly at the back of the, this was in Jacksonville, Florida, back of the arena, MTV crew comes in and we hear them say, where's Janet? We're here to do an interview. And she goes, Janet, who's in the cage with me, goes, oh no, I don't want to do that. I don't want them to see this. I don't want to see any of this magic. They can't know I'm here. So the assistant just covered up the front of the cage. And now I'm inside the cage, covered up with a piece of fabric.
And with her.
With her inside. And the video crew for MTV come up onto the stage and they go, okay, so where'd she go? Is she going to be back? And so the assistant goes, I don't know where she went. I think she left. I think we're done. And the producer says, that's all right. You know, we got all afternoon. We'll just wait. We'll just hang. And so the camera op takes his big giant beta cam and places it on top of the cage.
Yeah.
Resting his camera on our cage. And here we are inside this thing, you know, 18 inches away from the crew, totally silent. And they stay there for about 20 minutes. And it's like, oh my God. And it was scary. And it was also kind of exciting. And it's like, here I am trapped in a cage with Janet Jackson, but I can't say a word, you know? So
can't even move.
Finally, they left. That same, honest to God, Scott, I haven't talked to anybody about this. I haven't told anybody about this stuff. I don't know why we're here, but what the hell? So one more thing on Rhythm Nation, Janet Jackson. Again, it's time to do the final tech rehearsal. So we're in Jacksonville, Florida. And by this time, everything for me, my part had been done. I did a thing, this oil rig built itself at the beginning of the show, and then she appears at the top of it. And then we did the Black Panther thing in the middle of the show. And I think that was it. Maybe something else, but I think that was it. So I was basically set. My guys were running it and I was done. So, and back then, this was even before camcorder. So I didn't even shoot the freaking thing, which is so stupid. So It's time for the technical final technical rehearsal. That means video, lights, costumes, everything. Right across the street from the stadium was this great barbecue place. So I timed it all out so that I could get myself a big giant rack of barbecued ribs. And I set up my little car table right in front of the stage. And I sat down there. And basically, I had my ribs while the entire Janet Jackson Rhythm Nation team yeah. performed Rhythm Nation, the concert for me while I was eating my ribs. That's good times. That's
how much better moments. Could yeah. life be? You know, yeah. you got to be thinking. And what were you, 29, 30 at the time?
By that time, I was to be exact 28. Yeah. 28 years old. Yeah.
I mean, people, you had to be thinking there is nobody in the world who wouldn't want to be where I am right now.
Right. But you know, that's when I was kind of still enjoying it. I was still like mesmerized by the idea that I'm yeah. hanging out with Madonna and with Usher. And, you know, after a while it kind of gets old and you discover patterns and
it becomes more of a job.
Yeah. And I've done so many concerts, so many, you know, that I kind of got over it. You know, I remember doing Justin Bieber and I was on the deck and I did, I think I floated a business card or something. And he goes, "Oh man, you got to tell me how that works." And I go, "Yeah, I can't," you know, "No, you got to tell me." And then you do all the lines. "Yeah, I can tell you, but then right. I'll have to kill you. Can you keep a secret?" All that stuff. And he was getting really pissed off. Because I was the first person who told him no in a very long time, you know?
And I even like an adult.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, this is more, I'm done with this BS. I don't need it. The money is nice, but it's too much BS, you know? So I stopped pursuing concerts. I still get them. You know, I'm friends. Missy Elliott has become a friend. And every time she does anything, I get a call, you know, but I've stopped pursuing this work. I'm now just kind of taking what comes to me. And I still do, before COVID, I still do 2 or 3 a year, but it's not something that I want because if I pursue them, if I hunt the gig down, it changes the dynamic. It's like me wanting to work for this group. If they call me, it's a little less BS because they called me, but there's so much ego and there's so much garbage. It's just, it's not fun anymore. You know, there's something called a second album artist. When an artist does the first album, they're excited out of their minds. They're suddenly a star. And so they're really, really happy to be working with you. And it's the first time they're there. When they're in their second album, now they've had their asses kissed for a year and a half. And so they build this ridiculous ego and they become very, very difficult to work with. And it's just more garbage. And so it's like, what's the point? You know,
it probably gets worse as time goes on.
Yeah. Well, by the third album, they kind of figured it out. And then you work with really, I like it. Work with Cher. You know, yeah. She's been doing it for so many years. Those are the
she's
best.
She's got to do all those steps. So she's now a regular person.
Those are the best people to work with, or Garth Brooks, or the people who have been there for a long time. Back to Missy Elliott.
Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton. Yeah.
Well, I've never worked with Kenny Rogers. I did stuff with Dolly Parton, but those people are great to work with, but it's the in-between that's just too much BS.
Yeah, you know? Right. Well, I tell you what, as we start to wrap up, one of the things I want to talk about, since we are talking into the future as well, I know you had stopped the show in Macau for a variety of reasons.
Right.
Is there something
the contract, basically the contract ran off.
Oh, the contract. That's okay for a reason then. Yeah. The contract ran out, but they didn't renew that and they didn't continue, with that Illusion show there or?
Well, what happened is our contract ran out. And again, it's all politics. It's completely politics. So in Macau, like in Vegas, often the show is secondary, but it's the business of the show. And how can the most money be made for whoever is control of the business at that time? So in the case of Macau, again, without opening up a lawsuit. There are two people who had an opportunity to make a lot of money by shutting the project down and then trying to sell the space to another entity, not even for show business. And it has nothing to do with anything other than the movement of money. You know, you'll learn very early on in show business. Yeah. In show business, show is secondary to business. It's all about business, you know? And the more success you attain, and especially as your product becomes bigger, it is about moving money. So it's basically the thing ran its course and it came time to move money. And so in the end, I ended up taking all of the equipment. I got everything. And I then used that equipment to open up my next place, which is running in Sanya right now, in Sanya, China. It's called Magic Star, Franz Ferrari's Magic Stars. And then some of the equipment is back in Los Angeles and that I'm using for my tour when I tour again after the pandemic. So it's a cycle, you know, in this business, it's just a continuous cycle. It's the movement of equipment and money and resources. And the idea is to keep that machine running for as long as possible.
Yeah. I, again, we can kind of go on for a long time. And I remember hearing your lecture one time, I thought it was interesting about how you have the logistics of moving things that are going from in a ship from one country to another. Have other things already in another place and and then you fly someplace else by the time that ship arrives.
Right. I've got four units. I've got four show units, although honestly, unit number two and three are not as good as unit number one and two. But you need that, or at least I need that, because it takes a month, and now it's changed. It's gotten even worse. But it takes basically a month for a ship with carrying my sea containers. It's four sea containers, or five if I'm doing a big outdoor stunt. So between four and five containers, you put them on a ship, takes a month for them to get to pretty much anywhere in Asia, Southeast Asia, or the Middle East. Then once it gets there, it takes about a week to 10 days to clear customs. So including loading everything into the container in my warehouse in LA, it's a month and a half of travel. So if you've got gigs that are closer than a month to each other, you can't do it. So what'll happen is very, very often we have had one show unit goes out to one country. A second show unit goes out to the next country, and we're performing the first show unit while the second one gets to its destination. I remember we did this between Malaysia, Delhi, and Seoul, Korea. So we had a show running in Malaysia. We had a second unit going to New Delhi, India, and a third unit going to Seoul, Korea. While Malaysia was running, Delhi gets there. So I had to jump over to Delhi, do that show. I actually replaced myself in Malaysia with Mini-Me. Back then, that was Bob Borgia. I've since had 26 guys who have all learned how to do my show, who all look like younger, skinnier versions of me. Mm-hmm. So Bob Borgia is doing my show in Malaysia. I jump over to do Delhi. Delhi finishes. By that time, Korea has arrived. I jump over to do Korea. Now, all these shows are they're not slightly different. They're all completely different because I only have a handful of pieces of equipment that are duplicate. This like 2D, what I was talking about becoming flat, I've got like four of those, and I've got four things where I cut two people in half and switch their tops. But for the most part, it's all unique equipment, because what'll happen is once I do something, I do it, I figure it out. It's a thing, and now I'm bored with it, and I want to do the next
one. Move on.
Yeah. So after 40 years of doing this, I've just collected this ridiculous amount of stuff. So every show is its own show. So it's a bit of a brain screw to leave a show, hop over to another show, and then flip into that mode, flip into all those illusions. Remember all those sequences
that are there waiting for you, right?
Yeah. And the show itself is it's basically a machine, because it's all synced up to what's called show control, to a single computer. So music starts, video LED is connected to that, lighting is programmed to that, effects are programmed to that, all the automations are programmed to that. So it's basically a clock. So there's very, very little room for improv. You know, there are spots where I can stop and play with the audience, but it really is this clockwork machine, you know? So mentally having to flip from one machine to the other machine, that can mess with your brain pretty bad. But I've gotten used to it, and because of it, I've been able to keep touring in multiple locations without having to wait for that month and a half for everything to move over. That month and a half, you're still paying your people. You're still paying all your technicians. And
that's right. People got to eat.
Yeah. So you want to, anyway, again, this is like another, we can do another 2 hours on this, just on the logistics.
Each of these things have a lot of tangents where we can go.
Right.
It's been, I mean, even starting off the beginning about space, we have covered the universe, it seems like, of Franz Ferrari, just touched on some of the points over there. So as we close, let me ask you the question I always do for all of my guests. And that is, of course, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. What is it that's your philosophy of life? What are the words you live by that, what's your chi? What do you?
Philosophy of life or of magic?
It doesn't have to be a word. Yeah. What's important to you? I mean,
whatever you do, make sure you're having a good time. Because when it's done, that's all that matters. You know, 50 years from now, all this means nothing. Just you got to enjoy yourself and to make as many people happy along the way as you possibly can. You know, professionally, I make it a point. This is something I learned from Jackson, actually. Whatever I do, I try very hard to make it different and better than anything that came before. Different and better, which always means I'm slightly out of my league, which means I'm always taking a gamble and never really sure that anything is going to work.
Walking a tightrope.
Yeah, but in that, there's energy and there's excitement and there's life. And so...
Because you might fail.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have, you know. And so I leave in my wake, a trail of new material. You know, and I feel like you got to keep moving forward and you need to leave in your path this body of work that not only tells a story of who you are and who you were, but you need to forward the art form so you're not literally making the same donut and going on stage and doing a sub trunk every night.
Wow. Another whole podcast we can go into as creativity and to explore your creative muse and your mind and what you start with and how that goes. We're going to need to get together again.
Look forward to it.
Franz, this has been fantastic. Thanks, my friend, so much for your time.
I realize if you're watching this, you just see Occupy on my t-shirt going, what the hell is that?
Your t-shirt says Occupy Mars.
Oh, there you go. I'm sure viewers are going, whoa, what the hell? What is that? You know?
Going all the way again, full circle to the beginning. Yeah. We were talking about space and going out. And have you got your ticket yet?
Yes. Okay. My $200 Elon Musk pass. Yes.
Because you are future man. And there we go.
That's right.
Thanks, my friend. I appreciate it.
God, the pleasure has been mine.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Franz Ferrari. This is Scotty out. Wow, what an episode there. Thank you so much, Franz, so very much for laying all of those great stories and words of advice and some suggestions, tips. Oh, goodness. Wow, that was great. So great hanging out with you here for a little while. I know, listeners, this was just a little bit longer than our usual episode, but you can see I tried to keep this somewhat focused and somewhat centered, but there were so many different directions we could have gone down. And I'd like to hear from you if there are some things that you would like to hear us explore in more detail, just drop me a note. That would be scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. And I would like to get back to you and let you know, we will follow up a little bit more and go into more detail. And I'll give Franz another call and we will do just that. And also, I appreciate any other kinds of suggestions that you might have or people you might think would be of interest who would like to hear on this podcast in the future as well. As you know, probably over 80 to maybe 90% of the people I talk with
are people who I've worked with and have known for a long time, who are friends, so which makes our conversations all the easier, of course. But if you've got a particular topic or a person, just let me know that then as well. Of course, I really give special attention to those who are my friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who give us their financial support, so that way we can continue to keep this podcast going. And if you want to give us a little love, you can drop us some coin through patreon.com/themagicwordpodcast, and you can pledge your support financially each month through there, or you can do it through PayPal if you wish. And with that, you'll get some pretty good perks along the way then too. And one last thing, as I said the first part of this podcast, and I want to close out with this as a reminder, I could sure use your help if you would subscribe to my YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/TexasMagician. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and I'm going to leave you with two pieces of advice. Enjoy yourself and make as many people happy along the way as you possibly can. And whatever you do, try to make it different and better. This is Scotty out.